Welcome to the Hurricane Center podcast, produced by the Storm Science Network and part of the National Tropical Weather Conference. This podcast is made possible by USAA, the South Padre Island Convention and Tourist Bureau, and Plylox Hurricane Clips.
Thank you, Alex, and good morning, everyone. It is October the 12th. We welcome you to NTWC Live. We have a program for you today, which I think is not only going to be very, very interesting, but very, very important as we still talk about the impact of Ian. And we'll be talking about it for a long time here. And folks in Fort Myers are going to be talking about it for a generation or for generations. This may be hopefully the storm of record for a very long time. We don't see anything like this again for a long time. Just a bit, you'll meet our guests, Jason Dunning and Dylan Federico. They'll be joining us to talk about the storm from the Fort Myers perspective, along with Hurricane Hal, Dr. Hal Needham, who spent some time there following the storm, during and following the storm as well. I think it's going to be a really good perspective today on what happened. What happened? So we'll talk about that. Let's thank our sponsors. We've got the folks who make this event a possibility, USAA. USA has been part of what we've been doing for a very long time at the Storm Science Network and at the National Tropical Weather Conference, NTWC Live. We appreciate you, USAA, for all that you do. The South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau, the host of the National Tropical Weather Conference. We will be back on South Padre Island in April. We encourage you to be there with us for the National Tropical Weather Conference at the Marriott Courtyard, South Padre Island, beautiful venue for us. So we hope you'll join us for that. The Weather Company, Weather Boy, Walmart, the City of Brownsville, Texas, Black Magic Design, and the Port of Brownsville, all organizations that believe in what we're doing and believe in getting this word out to everyone around the world when it comes to tropical weather preparedness. And so we thank them for making this a possibility. All right, Hurricane Hal. Hal Needham. Dr. Hal Needham, CNC Catastrophe and GeoTrek Podcast. Hal, I listened to your latest podcast last night with James Grime and a lot of the people that you talked to while you were in Florida, and a great podcast. I encourage others to listen to it because you really, you know, it's just audio, but you make me feel like I'm there. You did a really nice job, Hal.
Tim, thank you so much. Yeah, the podcast was intense, and we're going to get into some of that, I think, in our discussion this morning. Just a lot of stories coming out of Southwest Florida. We're just starting to really even begin to see the scope of this catastrophe. Tim, thanks for the tropical weather update. Always good to see things kind of getting more quiet as we get closer to the end of the hurricane season. We're going to be talking today a lot about the impacts from Hurricane Ian. We have some special guests with us. We have Jason Dunning with NBC2, and we have Dylan Federico with WINK-TV, both in Fort Myers. I'm Dr. Hurricane Hal, extreme weather and disaster scientist with the GeoTrek project. Jason and Dylan, let's start with you guys. I really would love to hear your before, during, and after accounts of what was going on in your lives with Hurricane Ian. Jason, let's start with you. You've lived in the Fort Myers area in Southwest Florida for 11 years. You're a Florida native, originally from the St. Augustine area. Obviously, you'd never seen a storm quite like Ian. Could you walk us through the days before Ian as this storm is forming, as the forecast is getting a little tighter? What was going on in your life? Who were you communicating with? And just walk us through those days before the storm.
Well, you know, when the initial forecast came out for Ian, there was a great concern. And I think that was shared with most of the residents of Southwest Florida, because when that initial forecast cone came out, we were kind of right there in the squarely in that forecast cone for what was probably going to be ended up being a major hurricane. And, you know, I felt like we had people's attention early on, but there was a lot of focus on the cone and whether people were in the cone or outside of the cone. And that was a big source of confusion. And I feel like we kind of lost that sense of urgency as we went along, you know, going into the weekend, a few days. Landfall was Wednesday. And so I think getting into the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, as the cone shifted a little bit farther to the west, and we were kind of on the eastern fringe of it, at least from my observation, I think people thought that we were close to being in the clear. And as much as we tried to get people's attention and tell them, hey, it doesn't matter if we're in the cone or not, it's either going to be bad here or extremely bad. And we knew all along this was going to be some type of storm surge event for Southwest Florida. And unfortunately, it ended up being the worst type of storm surge event. And you know, people don't really have, we were talking about this earlier during the pre-show, I think our viewers and people in general have a hard time conceptualizing what that kind of storm surge looks like, you know, 10, 15, 18 feet of storm surge, and they really don't have a good reference point. And I think Irma kind of hurt us in that regard, because the forecast for Irma, at least the reasonable worst case scenario for that storm, looked pretty dire. And the storm ended up going in over Collier County, over Marco Island. So the Fort Myers area, Sanibel and Naples, never really saw that storm surge potential from the storm. And if Irma had gone 20, 30 miles to the west, it would have been a completely different story. So I think people don't, they had a hard time picturing what the storm surge looked like. You know, this is a river of water getting piled up and pushed on over the land. And as much as we tried to try to get that point across, I don't know that message was ever received. So I think that was really the challenge before the storm. And then during the storm, we knew it was going to be really bad when we started seeing some of the images coming out of Naples on the southeastern side of the storm. And if it was going to be that bad in Naples,
With the
early surge, yeah. So this is when the core of the storm was still off the coast of Lee County. So you had the onshore winds coming in over Collier County. And not to pay too much attention to the cone, because I think that was a fault of a lot of folks. But Naples was outside of the forecast cone. We tried to stress that there were going to be impacts well outside of the cone of possibilities. And Naples ended up with, I think, 4 to 7 feet of storm surge.
Sure. Jason, it sounds like you're saying early on, people were engaged. The track modeling started shifting farther west. People kind of lost interest, lost really the urgency. What about as the tracks then started shifting farther south and east? Did people kind of pick up that urgency, or do you feel like they continue to think this is going to be a Tampa storm?
I think as late as Monday, there was this feeling that it was still not going to happen here. Lee County did not issue evacuations until Tuesday morning. Charlotte County issued their evacuations on Monday. So I think it probably took until Tuesday that our viewers began to take the storm a little bit more seriously.
And it sounds like you're saying when that surge really started coming in, then people, it was really Wednesday morning that it's like, okay, here it is knocking on the door, it's happening.
It was so frustrating though, because we knew, even if the storm had gone up to Tampa, that we were going to see some pretty bad storm surge. We were going to get those onshore winds. And just trying to get that message across that even being outside of the forecast cone, you can get significant impacts. So we were really trying to focus on the impacts and the threats, and less so on, are we in the cone or are we outside of the cone?
Right, yeah, and I think that's the best messaging you can do, to focus on those impacts in the wide geographic area as well. Dylan, walk us through for you the days leading up to the storm. I mean, who were you communicating with? What were you looking at? What were your biggest concerns?
Yeah, and just to touch on Jason, my experience was very similar from a messaging standpoint, and just how things evolved as we got closer to landfall on Wednesday. I just feel like even as late as Monday night, there was just this sense that this thing, it's going to miss us. It's going to go north. It's going to be all right. I remember I filled up my gas tank Monday night, and there was not a single person in line in and out. And what happened Monday was interesting, because over the weekend, like Jason was saying, the track had shifted west. I think the GFS was as far west as Pensacola at one point. So people here were just, they weren't necessarily too worried about Ian. It was trending west, no big deal. And then Monday morning, I woke up and I was just thinking, uh-oh, everything was trending east and east and east. I was watching the hurricane and the recon, The storm was tracking to the right of the forecast constantly, and I just knew it was trouble. So even though on Monday there was this sense that it was still going to Tampa from most of the public, Jason and I, both of our channels, everybody here was really stressing the point that even if this misses us and goes to Tampa, at the best case scenario, this was just going to be a very bad brushing of the hurricane. But there was growing concern throughout the day on Monday that this was going to end up being a direct hit potentially to this area. And by Tuesday morning, it was too late. We were stressing from the get-go that the impacts were going to be felt well outside of the cone. This was going to be a much larger hurricane than Charley, considering the angle that it was coming in, that many people were going to see impacts well away from the storm in general. But by Tuesday morning, it was obvious it was coming, and it was just too late. People were evacuating. It was already raining. The weather was deteriorating. People were putting up their shutters in the rain. And I just think that going forward, we have to put more emphasis on the impacts will be felt well outside of the cone, especially in this type of a situation. And we really need to stop focusing on the center line as well, because I feel like the center line thing gave people a false sense of where the storm was going. And I think that we just need to communicate more where exactly this could go within the cone and who outside of the cone could feel those impacts as well. But I just think that at the end of the day, the way this evolved, it was very difficult to get the wording out so late by the time we got to Tuesday and landfall on Wednesday.
I hear both you guys really saying we need to focus more on impacts and less on the cone and less on the where the eye goes. So as you both had this sense of urgency and potential impending catastrophe, what did your individual messaging with people look like? Were people just dismissive? Were people skeptical, saying, hey, I've been here for previous storms, there wasn't a problem? Or were people somewhat receptive to, I'm talking friends, family, people that you're messaging with? Obviously, you're broadcasting to a wide audience. What about some of those individual interactions? Were people open to that or dismissive?
There, I would say there was a lot of dismissiveness, and people would use Irma as an example. You know, I think the last time that Southwest Florida saw this kind of storm surge was like 1873 was the last time that Lee County at least saw a direct landfall from a major hurricane, which at the time completely changed the landscape of Fort Myers Beach. People in my own building, I would have conversations. I think there were conversations on Monday, and, you know, they would bring up the spaghetti models, the spaghetti plots, and they, you know, they would make a comment like, oh, it looks like the storm's going west. Oh, it looks like it's going north of Tampa. I even remember hearing, I'm not trying to get too political, but I remember hearing the governor say that it's expected to go north of Tampa. And I said shortly after that, that, hold on, nobody knows where this storm is going. It is just kind of the nature of the beast. Whenever you have a storm approaching at an oblique angle like this, parallel to the coast, I mean, we've seen this with numerous storms. It just makes it a big forecast challenge. And it was kind of a similar situation 18 years ago with Hurricane Charley. So for whatever reason, yeah, people did not want to seem to believe that the storm was going to come into Southwest Florida. And I think part of that was all the different models, and I think, you know, in a way through the years we've kind of done that to ourselves, but the information is out there for people to look at, so they're going to see it anyway, so you might as well take a moment at least to try to educate people about the models. And as Dylan and I like to say, that windshield wiper effect, where every single day or sometimes every single model run, you're going to get some shifts east and west, and that's why you can't focus on those individual model plots. But yeah, so the models and then being on the outskirts, that far eastern side of the forecast cone, and that trend in the second half of the forecast away from Southwest Florida, I think people just kind of tuned out. Not everybody, but it was disappointing that you know, the lack of urgency in the response that we got with respect to evacuations.
Yeah, and just
yeah, go for it, Dylan.
Oh yeah, so Jason's 100% right. We heard a lot of, well, it's going to Tampa. Oh, well, the American model has it going to the Big Bend area. We heard a lot of that over the days leading up to the hurricane. And I think that a major problem leading up to this hurricane with the cone is this human psychology that I heard Ken Graham and Brian Norcross talking about in their podcast last year, which is anchoring. People over the weekend, they saw the cone setting this up into the panhandle. They're like, oh, it's shifting to the west. We have nothing to worry about. And they just tuned out. And coming into Monday when the forecast is changing, there was just this mentality around here that, oh, it's going to the west of us. It's going to miss us. We are okay. And people just have, once they see that, they just lock it in. And like Jason was saying, they tune out. And then at that point, the messaging becomes more and more difficult because people are wondering, well, why is the forecast changing? There's surprise and also just the very short amount of time that we had leading up to the hurricane once the forecast changed and trended this way led to a lot of problems as well. And, you know, something to think about too. I'm not going to get into today whether or not this will end up being a Category 5 hurricane once the postseason analysis is done, but this was a tropical storm just a few days before landfall. This wasn't an Irma type of situation where you saw it coming for almost a week out. This was just a tropical storm a few days out. So that alone led to a lot of problems leading to a short prepared time. And then the anchoring of people thinking, oh, it's going west just a few days before landfall really, really hurt the ability of not just us from a messaging standpoint, but I'm sure also the emergency management in these counties as well that have to use a lot of resources to put their evacuation orders in place and that kind of thing as well. So I just think anchoring was a big problem leading up to this.
And Dylan, when you're talking about anchoring, you're talking about that phenomenon where people get fixated on that first message they hear, and it's hard for them to get out of that mindset if something changes, right?
Yeah, I think that this was an argument against, I know there's been some talk about making a 7-day forecast cone. This is Exhibit A. Hurricane Ian is Exhibit A of why we should not do this, because we still have a lot of improving to do when it comes to forecasting these hurricanes, not just from the track, not just from the intensity, but also how we communicate the threat as well, because every hurricane is different. Some hurricanes are small and moving fast like Charlie. Some are large and moving slower like Ian. And while those two hurricanes made landfall in almost the exact same spot, you saw a completely different scope of impact from those two hurricanes. And I think that at the end of the day, while the cone does have some use, I think that we have to figure out a better way as meteorologists to really stress who can see the greatest impacts despite what the cone says at the time.
Yeah, really good insights there. I think the focus on the impacts, getting away from the cone and the exact landfall point. And like you said, if we're doing longer range projections, all of a sudden those have more tendency to shift around as well. Let's go into talk about what it was like for you guys on the day of landfall. And then let's go over to Tim for any online questions, if any have come in. What about, Jason, the day of landfall? So all of a sudden this is coming in. Like you said, Naples started going underwater early, and then we started seeing the images out of Fort Myers Beach, Fort Myers. I mean, where were you on the day of landfall? What were you doing? Who were you communicating with?
Yeah, so I got in around 2 o'clock in the morning that Wednesday. And what was most alarming and concerning for me was seeing throughout the morning, the peak storm surge forecasts jumping up every few hours. And we got to a point where it was, you know, between 10 to 16 feet in that ballpark. And then peak surge was around 16 to 18 feet. And then I knew, you know, this is going to be, I was certain at that point that this is going to be a catastrophic type storm surge event. And I think it was around 8 or 9 o'clock. I walked up to the anchor desk and I talked to the anchors and I said, look, we need to make one last plea to people to leave, at least get out of the flood zone. You know, you just have to get on the east side of I-75. And so we tried something. We have a huge video monitor in our studio. It's about 10 feet high. So I walked up there with the anchors and we were just having a conversation about, you know, what kind of storm surge we were looking at. And so I pulled out a tape measure and wanted to illustrate and allow viewers to kind of see for themselves what 3 feet of surge looks like, what is 7, 10, you know, and so on, all the way up to 18 feet of surge. And then at one point we zoomed out so they could see the top of our monitors, the top of the big video board, which again was about 10 feet high. And I just wanted them to see the scale of the storm surge that we were talking about. And I hoped that, you know, for anybody who was kind of on the fence, I know some people decided they were staying, they weren't going to do anything differently. But I hope for somebody sitting on the fence that they saw that and then made that decision, that was enough for them to say, okay, I'm getting out of here. So my number one focus was trying to get people out of that storm surge zone. But knowing that 90% of hurricane deaths come from the water. And unfortunately, that's what ended up happening. The storm surge from some of the surveys that I've seen, Fort Myers Beach, I've seen measurements up above 15 feet so far. And it's just, you know, you look back over the last, you have a lot of time to kind of think and reflect on your coverage, and you hope that you did enough and the messaging was clear enough to get people to react. But in a way too, I feel like it's also a shared responsibility, right? And you can only do so much. You get the information out there. And I think people in Southwest Florida sometimes, and really anywhere, they wait and kind of take the lead from local emergency managers. They wait for those mandatory evacuations. And that's kind of their cue to say, okay, we should leave.
Yeah, Jason, I think you were right in your concern with the surge. I love that you were finding creative ways to communicate. You know, sometimes we just communicate in numbers. You were trying to mm-hmm. communicate as best as you could with creative visuals. I think storm surge is maybe so far outside of people's frame of reference. I mean, as far as deep water, maybe we know of, we could think of the deep end of a swimming pool, but that's mm-hmm. just standing water. I mean, this is a raging sea moving in at 12 or 15 feet, nothing survivable at ground level. It sounds like you did what you could to kind of show some visuals with that.
Yeah, and we were really trying to think outside the box, and we knew that there were not many people in the shelters. I think at the time there were, you know, there was space for 40,000 people at the shelters. I think they hit 4,000 people. And so we knew that most everyone was staying. And so that was really weighing on me. And so I felt like, you know, we had to make one last attempt to try to get people out. And then, you know, I was really careful because my intent was not to try to scare people. And I think a lot of, you know, people did get scared, but I think sometimes the information is scary. There's no really a good way to sugarcoat it. And sometimes that's how people have to act. But I think we did a good job as a team just staying calm and just, you know, telling people, look, this is what we're facing, and this is what you need to do to be able to survive. And then a little bit later that morning, I decided let's get somebody on from the National Hurricane Center, because maybe, you know, if they're not going to listen to me, maybe they'll listen to Jamie Rome or Dr. Michael Brennan. And so we brought them on, and they kind of reiterated, and this was a little bit later in the morning, I guess it was around 10 o'clock or so, and they said, you need to leave now. And I asked them again, I just said, hey, just making sure, you still think it's okay to leave? And Dr. Brennan said, yes, you still have, you know, 1 to 2 hours to leave where you are if you're in a flood zone. And I hope that some people did listen.
Yeah, Jason, I trust that those urgent messages at the end did make a difference, even if it's just for a few people that got out of harm's way. You mentioned that people kind of waited really long on a directive, maybe from emergency management or official evacuations, or just really waiting. In my experience, I've seen when people in their perception have unnecessarily evacuated before, on mm-hmm. the next storm, like this happened where I live in Galveston, Texas, there was a massive, the evacuation was deadly for Hurricane Rita, and people just interpreted that was an unnecessary evacuation. They're going to wait a lot longer next time. That was in 2005. 3 years later, here comes Hurricane Ike. People were flat-footed. They wanted to wait, and by the time they decided to evacuate, their evacuation route was underwater. So it's a lot of times we're not only dealing with the storm in front of us, but the storm that mm-hmm. happened in most recent history, unfortunately.
And that's why, and I think Dylan said it too, that's where I think Irma kind of hurt us a little bit, because that was their last frame of reference. And yeah. It was a massive evacuation all across the state of Florida. I remember some of the hate mail that we got after Hurricane Irma. People, you would think they would be happy after they came home and see that their house was still standing, or sure. that it wasn't flooded in water. But you know, we got a lot of frustration from people who left and felt like they didn't need to leave. So I think that definitely played a role in that. You know, I would hate to be in those meetings, emergency managers making those tough decisions. And I understand the information that they were looking at, and it was a really difficult forecast.
But yeah, tough decisions for them. And I think tough decisions too for broadcast meteorologists. You're trying to find that balance where you're not overhyping things, but you're also not underselling either. You're trying to find mm-hmm. that balance the best you can, right?
Yeah, and we can't, it's hard as a meteorologist to tell people that it's time to leave when you don't have when you don't feel like you have that partnership, you know, at all levels, kind of reinforcing that message.
Sure, that makes sense. It helps if there's a cohesive message, of course. Jason, thanks for sharing those insights and observations and your story from the day of landfall. Dylan, what about you? I mean, the day of landfall, where are you? What's going on in your life? Who are you communicating with? Could you walk us through that day for you?
Well, I just remember going to bed on Tuesday night, and Ian was undergoing an eyewall replacement cycle. And I thought, well, there's a little bit of shear. Maybe it levels off some as it moves inland. And I remember I had Jim Eds. He's a very famous storm chaser. He stayed here, and I told him before I went to bed, I was like, I'm going to get up at 5 and just take a look at everything and see what the hurricane is doing. I wasn't supposed to be at Wink until noon on Wednesday. So I got up at 5, and I just saw it, and I just had flashbacks to Laura and Ida the past couple of years. It just had that look. It had strengthened to a Category 4. The structure on radar was very impressive, and I just knew that this was going to be a type of event where people's lives and communities would be changed forever. So I got up. I told Jim what was going on. He got up. I got ready for work immediately. I was very concerned about storm surge here in downtown Fort Myers. I live in downtown Fort Myers about 2 minutes from Wink. So I have a parking garage here at my building. I parked my car up on the fourth floor of the building because I was very worried about surge even up here. I got into work about 7 o'clock. Somebody from Wink came and picked me up and brought me to the station. And at that point, just knowing that this place was about to get blasted by a potentially catastrophic hurricane, I did everything I could from a social media perspective. And when I got at the desk and spoke with the anchors about what was going on with the hurricane, just to clearly articulate what was about to happen and make one final plea to get people out of the storm surge zone. And Jason and I had a very similar experience. I remember it was around 10 o'clock. The hurricane was getting close. It was paralleling Naples and Bonita. The water had bottomed out in Fort Myers Beach. You could walk out into the Gulf a little bit if you want. I mean, I'm not saying you should, but you could. The water was very low. And I remember our anchor, Lois Tomey, was asking about the surge. And I said, well, looking at our Naples pier camera, the surge was coming in very badly. It came in fast and hard. And I said, look, I was looking at the gauges. Water's bottomed out at Fort Myers Beach, but I'm looking at the gauges in Naples, and the gauge had almost a parabolic look from the water rising so rapidly. And I just said, time's about to run out at Fort Myers Beach. The surge is expected to be catastrophic. This is a completely different storm than Charley, than Irma. You know, comparing Charley, small hurricane, moving 20 miles per hour, Ian slow-moving hurricane, moving 5 miles per hour, much larger. The surge was going to be something that nobody here, at least for this generation, has seen before. So just playing for people to get out at the last minute, hopefully somebody listened. But what was almost as terrifying as anything, I remember I got in, and the hurricane had almost slowed down to a crawl at that point early in the morning. And it was evident, it was just obvious that it was about to start running to the right. And sure enough, it did. And it made that run towards Lee County. And within a very short amount of time, the surge came up rapidly along Fort Myers Beach. I remember being at the desk, and Ian was my sixth major hurricane. I lived through Katrina. I had chased several other hurricanes, intercepted them. And one thing that I noticed about storm surge with these monster Category 3 plus hurricanes making landfall is when that wind shifts, that water comes in fast. It comes in within minutes. And there's no better example of that surge coming up. You can see it just come in super fast. Either on Mark Sutton's camera from Mexico Beach in Hurricane Michael, or Brett Adair, who was in Mexico Beach in his Tahoe when the surge came up. It came up within 3 or 4 minutes. And if you're in your vehicle, there's a very good chance that you may not be able to make it out. And unfortunately, and Jason was talking about this, how that people here just don't have a good grasp of what storm surge can actually do. And unfortunately, with hurricane,
We may have lost his signal.
Yeah, I think you've frozen on us, Dylan. Sorry about that. Go ahead, Hal.
And they found that people were in their cars trying to escape storm surge. I just think that just pleading for people to get out.
Yeah, thank you for that, Dylan. You're right. It can come up so incredibly quickly. Is everything okay with the audio feed right now? It seemed like a few different people may have been frozen there. Can everyone hear and see?
I can, yeah.
Yeah, I see you moving outside, Dylan. I think we lost your connection,
okay.
But you're back.
Yeah, the power the power actually just went out in my building. So
I guess my Wi-Fi cut out, but you guys can hear me, right?
You're spot on with that. Storm surge can come in incredibly quickly when the wind changes direction. You can see it in the graphs. We see it in the videos. But you're right. That's what takes a lot of people by surprise. In this case, it seemed to come in on the second half of the storm for a lot of folks.
Yeah, and something else about storm surge, too. I went down to Fort Myers Beach a couple of days after the hurricane, and you can tell which structures were built with that modern coating and which ones weren't. The older stuff was just absolutely devastated by Hurricane Ian, and the newer stuff did hold up very well with it. But something that about storm surge that people need to consider as well going forward is it's not just the water rise. You can be in a strong house built for strong hurricanes like Ian, but the thing you have to consider is the things that are in the water as well. Think about all of the boats that came in with the storm surge with Hurricane Ian. And you can be in a strong house, but if you have the storm surge and you have one of these 70-foot shrimp boats banging up against your house as well, there's a good chance your house is not going to make it in this type of a hurricane. And I can tell you, when I drove into Fort Myers Beach, the boats were all – there were a couple of miles inland all the way into – there's this road called Summerlin. The storm surge penetrated way inland. So I know a lot of these structures that didn't make it from the storm surge in the first place, they were likely getting bulldozed by these large boats banging up against their structures as well. And a close friend of mine, her name's Amanda, she has a three-story house just off of Fort Myers Beach, literally right before the bridge. Jason knows what I'm talking about, where there's a lot of boats. And the storm surge came into the second floor of their house. And they were very fortunate that one of those boats did not hit their home when that storm surge came in. So I think that that's something else that we need to communicate with the public going forward. That it's not just the water, but it's what's in the water as well that makes it life-threateningly dangerous to stay in your home for this type of a dangerous hurricane coming in.
Yeah, Dylan, you're spot on with that. It's fast-moving water, right? It's not only the boats, but when your neighbor's house collapses, all that wood and all that debris, right? They're pilings. It has to go somewhere. If you're downstream from that, you can get hit really hard. Really good insights there. Tim, let's go. I wanted to go over to you. Do you have any questions that have come in online? I know a lot of times our viewers have some questions for us. Anything come in yet?
We do have some good questions. I'm going to start with this one, though, because Dylan, the fact that your power went out right now brings up the point that until then, it looked like life is normal where the two of you are sitting. We know that's not true. Jason, I see your water behind you, so you're stocked up for a while still. but you know, how different is life? Because, again, it looked normal until your power went out. How different is life now? It's not just get up and go to work anymore. There's something completely different about what you do. And, Jason, Dylan, you're outside, so go ahead and talk about that first because your power went out on you.
Look, just growing up in New Orleans, I've just been through this so many times when the power goes out during a tropical storm or a hurricane, and it's all fun and games until the power goes out. That once the power goes out, you quickly realize that every little thing that you take for granted on a daily basis goes away. You walk into your apartment. You by habit, you flip the light. It doesn't come on. You can't cook anything. You can't drink the water because there's a boil water advisory in effect. You're snacking on Clif Bars and drinking water bottles and just living off of that. Even right now, we're still under a boil water advisory here in Fort Myers. out of habit, you know, you go brush your teeth and you turn on the sink and you realize, oh, I can't use this water. You have to use a bottle of water to just, you know, wet your toothbrush. It's just every little thing that you take for granted on a daily basis in 2022 goes away instantly. And it just goes to show you how delicate the lifestyle that we enjoy today is when you go through a hurricane like this.
Jason, how about you? How is life different now than it was 3 weeks ago?
You know, I was fortunate that we only lost power for a few days where I was at, but I can tell you Cape Coral, for example, which is our largest populated area. I think it has just over 200,000 people who live there. It took, I guess it was about a week and a half before power eventually started getting restored in Cape Coral. So Lee County got hit really hard. There was one point after the storm where I think it was like 98 to 99% of people in Lee County did not have power. And then now we're finally down to below 5%. Thankfully, we had a lot of radio partners, and so we're able to simulcast. And I can't tell you how many emails we've gotten from people who were listening to us on the radio who were so thankful that they had some way to get information. So that was very valuable. And then you also have to think when you're broadcasting on air during the storm and after the storm, to think like a radio person and just be as descriptive as you possibly can for those who can't really see what you're talking about. You know, I think we've made a lot of progress in the last couple of weeks in terms of restoring power and, you know, cleaning up and rebuilding, but it is going to be a long road to recovery, and things might not feel like normal until a few months from now, maybe even longer.
Could be a very long time.
Yeah.
It's a generational storm. You know, it really is. Yeah. And takes years and years and years. A good question coming in from online, Dave, is asking if anyone showed the predicted wind field to show the size of the storm. So that pinpointing landfall as a dot isn't very helpful as a communication strategy. And I think we all agree with that. And then he said the angle of approach also plays a role in coastal impacts. So, but wind field specifically, were you guys showing the wind field, Jason?
Yeah. We definitely were, because I think that really helps to visually see how large the storm is. And it's not just one point on the map. So we were showing the wind field. One thing that I did in the days leading up to the storm is I kind of, and I think Dylan, maybe you were doing the same thing, but I used the forecast cone to show different scenarios, worst case scenario, best case scenario for us. So I would show the storm on the far right or eastern side of the storm and kind of go over what kind of threats and impacts we were going to see. I would move the storm over a little bit to the west at that time in the middle of the cone, what kind of impacts would we see under this scenario? And then the best case scenario goes maybe a little bit farther west. So we have tried to be as transparent as possible and just kept trying to reinforce the idea or the uncertainty in this forecast. At one point, I even took a sentence from the National Hurricane Center forecast discussion. And it was something along the lines of, it cannot be overstated how uncertain the long-range forecast is for Hurricane Ian and why it's important to stay updated. So I said, hey, this is coming directly from the National Hurricane Center. Nobody knows where this storm is going to make landfall. And, you know, at this point, landfall is maybe not as important because we're still going to see impacts regardless. And so let's stop focusing on exactly where that landfall point is going to be and let's focus on the impacts.
Jason, I like what you were saying there about the uncertainty. I remember last week, Brian Norcross mentioned be certain about your uncertainty kind of thing. Like, so there was a lot of uncertainty in the track, right? We weren't exactly sure exactly where the eye was going to go. That said, when you have a large, powerful hurricane coming into the shallow water of the west coast of Florida, it was highly certain that somewhere was going to get a catastrophic surge. We just didn't know exactly what region, right? But the uncertainty, I think, was in the precise track. But like you've been saying, and you and Dylan have been saying, this is really a large geographic area that's going to be impacted, not just a point.
Yeah, I tried to be as transparent as possible. Tell them what you know. Tell them what you don't know. And I think we were both hopeful that we would get a lot more clarity on the forecast 3-4 days out. but you know, the models were still did not have the strong consensus either way, but I think we probably got a little too bogged down on, you know, here's the American forecast model, here's the European forecast model, this is doing this, and maybe we could have paid even more attention to the impacts of the storm.
And Dylan, what about you? What were you guys doing to talk about impacts versus where that center line is? Because it's so,
you know, yeah, I think that's something that we need to do as meteorologists going forward. And this is just something that I think is something that we need to learn from Hurricane Ian, which is we need to do less of this GFS versus European stuff leading up to a big hurricane, because I think at the end of the day, especially when there's big differences between these models, it leads to a lot of confusion with the public and what to expect with the hurricane. So the approach that I took leading up to Hurricane Ian, especially Monday and into Tuesday, I did a county by county impacts graphic, giving a reasonable worst case scenario of what to expect with Hurricane Ian. Obviously on Tuesday, that forecast was a lot more aggressive than it was on Monday, just given the fact that starting Monday morning, the models began to shift east every single run. And I'm not even talking about GFS Euro. I'm talking about the consensus models, the best of the best, the ensembles, just an overall broad picture of all of the guidance that we rely upon to make these forecasts leading up to a hurricane. Everything was shifting to the right. So naturally you would go more aggressive as you got closer, but just leading up with it, I try to use as little deterministic model data as possible just because of the volatility that we were seeing with the two leading global deterministic models. So I just think, like, from a philosophical standpoint, I would prefer to just give a forecast with a reasonable worst case scenario that people can grasp and see for where they live, because that's what ultimately what everybody wants is a forecast for their house. And at least with Ian, that's what I was trying to do. These graphics included the timing of the worst weather, the storm surge, how much rain they were going to see, the wind gusts. And when I was ad-libbing with each one of these counties, I was trying to describe what you would see, including along the coast, stressing the fact that the storm surge was going to be potentially life-threatening. And unfortunately, that part of the forecast did verify, and it does weigh very heavily on me to this day.
Do you think too much information is a bad thing? You know, the viewers now have, you know, 17 weather apps on their phone, and they've got access to the models, you know, which is fine. But, you know, Joe sitting in Fort Myers Beach says, well, you know, my model says it's going to go to, you know, mm-hmm. to Tallahassee or something, you know, and they've got too much information. And my buddy down the street, who's always right, said it's going to go to Tampa, you know, and we've learned to not trust the right sources anymore. You know, yes, they're listening to us. They've got the TV on, but they're also looking at the app that says, you know, maybe Joe says it's going to go somewhere else.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's like a paralysis analysis. You know, I was talking to
you. You need to look no further.
Oh. Sorry about that, Dylan.
Oh, no, you go.
Go, Jason.
Okay. I was interviewing Brian Norcross for the Hurricane Andrew anniversary, and I asked him a question. I said, do you think it's a lot easier now to get the message out there for people than it was back in 1992? And Brian said no, it was actually a lot easier because you didn't have these competing information streams with all these mixed messages out there. You know, everyone kind of watched the local news or watched another, maybe the Weather Channel or something. And the message was a lot clearer than it is now, you know, with all these social media pages, all the amateur meteorologists saying it's going to go here. And then you get inundated with all the forecast modeling. And it's just, it's very hard I think for the users to find a unified message, and that leads to confusion and inaction.
Dylan?
Yeah, I agree 100% with what Jason's saying. He's spot on. But as far as the too much information thing is concerned, it is a huge problem. And you need to look no further than tropical tidbits leading up to a big hurricane. You go on and the website is slowed down to a crawl because of the amount of traffic. And it's because every Joe Schmo out there is on there looking at the latest GFS, looking at the latest European model, and trying to interpret what these models are saying without noticing or knowing their tendencies and their biases and what the without the context of what it actually means. And as a meteorologist, and I know Jason goes through the same thing as well, where you're trying to explain these tendencies, but people look at the American model and think, oh, it's going to miss us. They have it anchored in their head that it's not coming here. And then you're, at this point, you're just talking in one ear and out the other ear. So I just think that at this point going forward, we just have to do the best job that we can do to communicate the impacts and to tell people what to expect in their locations.
You know, and you make a great point. And Dave, the guy who asked the question earlier, says, you know, everybody's an amateur meteorologist. Everybody looks at that stuff, looks at tropical tidbits and makes their own forecast. But we and everybody collectively needs to leave that to the people who do nothing but forecast hurricanes all day, every day of their lives. That's the National Hurricane Center. Nobody's better. And we need to let them do that work and then listen. And we broadcasters focus on the impacts. I think that's really significant. You'd be pleased to know, by the way, that Brian is watching this morning, Brian Norcross, and he's commented that it's interesting that people don't think of Hurricane Wilma as a Southwest Florida hurricane, even though it was a Cat 3 only 80 miles to the south. They don't think of Wilma as being a Southwest Florida hurricane. Just a fascinating point that he makes. And that's right, because we think about Ian, we think about Charlie, but Wilma's mm-hmm. not one we often think about. We're getting close to the end of time. Hal, jump back in if you got a couple of final questions and ask them. I'll keep watching the feed, but just a couple more minutes.
Yeah, that sounds great, Tim. Can everyone see my screen there?
Yes.
Just real quick, just some slides from my chase. This was the NHC forecast on Tuesday at 11 a.m. You can see, I mean, again, we have the cone that we've been talking about. Best guess was maybe a major hurricane coming near Siesta Key, Sarasota. I was shocked to drive around that very area around Sarasota, Siesta Key. This is low-lying area around Siesta Key down to Venice Beach. All these homes are pretty much slab on grade. I interacted with some homeowners just really defiant in the sense that they're not going to be impacted. I talked to a guy whose home was at 7.5 feet. He said he's not worried about flooding. He's been there his whole life. He knows Florida hurricanes. This is driving around Venice. This at that time, it looked like the biggest impacts would be up in this area. This is a day before landfall. Everything's open. Publix is open. If you want a barber shop, a massage, whatever you wanted, it was all open the day before landfall. And a major hurricane is forecast for the next day. The storm surge forecast at that time was 6 to 12 feet from around Longboat Key down to south of Fort Myers there. I went over to Punta Gorda on the bay there by Charlotte Harbor. We were expecting potentially 6 to 12 feet. The NHC forecast was putting potentially 9 feet of surge over the ground. I found a parking garage. I was able to get the pressure there, 954. I made a friend in the disaster zone, Jose Garcia. He's been chasing hurricanes for a long, long time. He's a NOAA meteorologist. And he brought his, I don't know if that's his grandma's barometer. He brought an old school barometer to the chase, which I thought was interesting, measuring pressure in mercury. One of those ones where you tap the glass, and we got the same pressure. He got 28.18 inches. I got 954 millibars. But in Punta Gorda, we did not get any surge. But, man, did we get pounded by the back half of the eye, the second eye wall coming through. Jose has been chasing hurricanes for a long time. He thinks that our wind speeds there were low 130s, probably low-end Cat 4. But, again, we narrowly missed the storm surge. It was a huge hit there. The roofs in Punta Gorda actually did really well. This area did get hit by Category 4 winds from Charlie, and everyone says they built back stronger. But obviously, this is North Fort Myers, a tremendous amount of wind destruction. Get into South Fort Myers, you see a lot of flood impacts there. You know, there was just still a lot of storm surge and abandoned cars the day after landfall down there in South Fort Myers. Yachts on pickup trucks. I mean, it just got really bad down there. A woman from Illinois wrote out the storm in the southern part of Fort Myers. And this is what a picture she gave to me. I mean, people really were kind of blindsided. Brian Norcross mentioned Hurricane Wilma. I found this sign kind of gives the hurricane history for Southwest Florida. Donna, Charlie, Wilma, Irma, Ian. What I thought was really interesting was this is the Irma track. And you can see the surge happened out here by the Everglades, but Fort Myers is up here. Cape Coral's here. I wrote out the storm in Punta Gorda up here. All those huge population areas were west of Irma's center line. And so they didn't see the surge. As far as people, the people I interacted with, it's as if Irma surge never happened. It happened. It was just not in a highly populated area. So I thought that was interesting that we've talked about Charlie and Irma on this broadcast. I think in the future, I will kind of come alongside people and say, I realize in your perception, you've ridden out two Cat 4 hurricanes before that did not have flooding. This one's different, and here's why. That Irma track for me is a bit haunting, that the fact that there was a surge, just not in the populated areas. Last two things here. Tim was talking about my podcast. I was on the ground for about 8 days. I've done two podcasts. You can hear a lot of people's perspective on the ground there on the GeoTrek podcast. And lastly, I do want to close with this. I thought about sharing this or not. This is a Facebook screenshot from a man who lived in the surge zone. He did not survive the storm. He drowned. And what I thought is interesting, on the day of landfall, he has this picture of his house, his street. He says, hopefully didn't make a bad decision to stay. But on this screenshot on his page is the storm surge forecast. He's in the 12 to 16 foot zone. So, I mean, he received the information. It just didn't connect with how catastrophic this could be or in action. I mean, no disrespect by showing this, but I think it showed me people even were receiving the information. Just somehow it didn't relate to the idea that this could have catastrophic and life-threatening conditions where they live. Those are just a few last things that I wanted to share from my field work. I really appreciated the great conversation we had today. I don't know if anyone else has a last thought or two, but I thought we had a really constructive conversation on the conference today.
Yeah, why don't Dylan? Why don't you give us your final thoughts in 60 seconds on what your takeaways from this storm are or were?
Yeah. So going forward, like I said, with Hurricane Ian and the lessons that we learned from it, got to focus less on the center line and more about the impacts that people are going to see from the hurricane, not just inside of the cone, but also potentially well outside of the cone as well. That means hitting very hard on storm surge, what exactly storm surge means, what it means for your community, winds, what it can mean for your home, power outages, tornado threat, seen a lot of river flooding after Hurricane Ian as well. So I think going forward, the main takeaway is that you have to focus less on that center line and focus more on impacts and how that's going to impact every single person that is listening to you. And at the end of the day, it's very tough to deal with the death toll and what happened after this hurricane, but at the end of the day, you just have to go out there and do the best job that you can do. And I feel like I did the best job that I could do leading up to Ian. And I'm sure Jason feels the same way as well.
Great takeaways, and really appreciate it. Important information. By the way, Dylan, you'll be pleased to know that's Jim Ed's picture back there from the Eye of Dorian. your buddy Jim Ed's from the Eye of Dorian a few years ago. Jason, what about you? Your final thoughts and your takeaways. In 60 seconds.
I'm really proud of the coverage that our team did overall, and I think we emphasized the storm surge, the impacts. This is a storm we're going to be talking about for a long time, and I echo pretty much all of what Dylan said. And you know, I wonder if this storm will lead to any kind of discussion as far as what kind of products are issued from the National Hurricane Center. I've seen some different ideas floated around. You know, something like changing the size of the cone based on the inherent uncertainties with the forecast. So I'm just interested in the discussion and what we can learn from this in terms of how to get the right message out to the public. It's very sad to be on the side of it, you know, to deal with one of the deadliest storms in Southwest Florida and Florida in general. And so I, you know, we'll continue to reflect on what we did and how we can do it better. But I think overall, I'm proud of the job that we did. And I hope people take storm surge more seriously.
Really important message. Really important message. You know, from a national perspective, even probably a local perspective, the focus so often has been on how many lives were lost. But you two guys, take some time to focus on how many lives you saved, because you did. You know, you did. You did your job, you did it well, and you saved lives, and that's really important. So focus on that side of it for a little while and know that you've made a difference. So we appreciate your work today and throughout the storm. Good job, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Thank Howe, you. Thank you for your amazing insight as well and for sharing those pictures and videos from your time there, because that is important stuff. And I know that's going to help in your continued research and what you're doing. So Dr. Howe, thanks for what you continue to do.
Yeah, and thank you, Jason and Dylan. I completely agree with you guys focusing more on the impacts. And again, the cone, you know, I'd rather be 30 miles to the left of the eye than 90 miles to the east. I think the cone and the eye position, people are focused on too much on that and not enough on the impact. So appreciate the great work you guys are doing, and hopefully the dialogue continues.
Great, guys. Thank you all. Terrific presentation today. You know, this is being recorded. It's made into a podcast, so others will listen to it. Brian, for joining us today and listening in. Craig Setzer, thanks for being part of the program. He was with us today as well, listening in online. So we appreciate you guys and everybody else. Dave Jones, all who are with us today. That wraps up today's program. Great show. Jason Dunning from NBC2 in Fort Myers. Dylan Federico from Wink TV in Fort Myers. Dr. Hal Needham from CNC Catastrophe and the GeoTrek podcast. Listen to it. There's some great insight, and it really takes you into the heart of the storm. So, Dr. Howe, thank you for that. I want to thank our sponsors, USAA, the South Pottery Island Convention and Visitors Bureau, the Weather Company, Weather Boy, Walmart, the City of Brownsville, Black Magic Design, and the Port of Brownsville. We'll be back live in person in April, South Pottery Island, Courtyard by Marriott. We hope you can come join us, meet everybody, and hear stories, and hopefully make what we do next time around just a little bit better. Thanks for joining us. Next week, it's Mark Suddeth. He's here to talk about some of the video that he got from the storm. Until then, take care. Have a great week. See you next Wednesday at 10.
Loved what you've heard on this week's episode? Well, the answer is simple. It would mean the world to us if you could head over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review and feedback. Spreading the word really is the best way to grow our podcast and achieve even greater things. Thank you. Thank you.